Hello, bonjour et bienvenue. I'm Jason Solomons and I'm in Cannes. Yes, mes amis, as this 60th festival heads into its final days, I'm still here. I chat to the king of Latin cinema, Javier Bardem, the best actor contender for his performance in the latest Coen Brothers picture. And I bring you Britain's brightest new movie star, Sam Riley, whose portrayal of Joy Division's Ian Curtis in the movie Control has been the talk of the town. With frank reviews of all the films and the skinny on the parties, it's Film Weekly at Cannes, and I'm Jason Solomons. This was the year that Quentin Tarantino finally flopped and flipped. Although he's a former Cannes winner and jury president, the presentation of his Death Proof here was one giant cock-up. It's a bad film stretched into a terrible one after Harvey Scissorhands Weinstein abandoned the original Grindhouse concept. The Weinstein Company's spin nurses have been protesting all week that this was always the plan. What rubbish. American Beauty did come from David Fincher's superbly nihilistic Zodiac and from Gus Van Sant's latest effort to watch teenage boys take their tops off, Paranoid Park, a languorous, beautiful work about a skate kid accidentally killing a security guard in Portland, Oregon. Entourage, the TV show about a Hollywood actor, his chums and a rapacious agent, won a BAFTA back in England last week for Best International TV Show. The show's huge in America and quickly becoming a cult in Hollywood, where real-life actors and agents have taken to aping the character's behaviour around town, even going to lengths of commissioning one of their spoof films, Aquaman. Following their legendary Sundance episode, the boys were in town to shoot one in Cannes. I grabbed them before they went on set, meeting up with Kevin Dillon, less successful brother of Cannes regular Matt Dillon, who plays the desperate wannabe drama.
I just happen to have like a big storyline in this episode, so nobody's going to have more work to do than me here. So I'm not going to get to do all the partying. I'm going to have to live vicariously through my fellow castmates. And they're going to have to tell me how much fun they had.
But that must be good for drama. I mean, he's getting his break, surely.
It's always nice to get a good storyline. And it really is. I'll have to come back here some other time and do it right.
You'd rather be in a pool on an inflatable with a cocktail?
I would, yeah. Nice pina colada. Maybe getting a foot massage. No, I'm not a big massage guy. I'm just kidding. I don't know why I said that, but I do like a pina colada. Don't get me wrong. You know, I want to come out. I want to play golf. I hear there's a really nice golf course around here. So, and I got a group of buddies I play golf with. I'm a member at Wingfoot in New York. We had the U.S. Open last year. It's a really great golf course.
Really tough golf course.
Yeah, it's a very tough golf course. So I'm used to tough golf.
Does your brother play?
No, Matt's the only one of the brothers in my family that doesn't play, but he's starting to show a little interest in it. He's a lefty, and my dad said, if you want to play this game, you have to play it as a righty, which is a very old school way to go about it. And now then he tried to go back to a lefty, so it got him all screwed up. But it feels good to be connected to a hit. It really comes down to the hits, you know, and if you get one that clicks. Yeah, you got to hit it on the screws. But it's different because in golf, if you hit a good shot, you get rewarded for it. You can make a good movie and nobody sees it, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
But or a good show and have it get canceled. Luckily, HBO was, you know, they let you run with it a bit. They give you a real chance. And our first two episodes, I didn't think were very, very good. But by episode three, there hasn't been a bad episode since. And we really kind of got our stride. Thank you, HBO.
When I met you guys, you were all having breakfast together, cooking eggs and stuff. It was like walking into a set of Entourage, yeah, in real life.
Well, yeah, it was, except I didn't have to do the cooking, you know. And on Entourage, I'm always stuck. And whenever I have a kitchen scene, I'm like, oh, no, a kitchen scene, because I know I'm going to have to 50,000 props, and I have tons of dialogue, and you're juggling all that. But, yeah, I mean, we hang out together. We love each other. These guys are great. I have to say they're really good guys, and I just personally really love all of them, you know.
There's a famous episode of Seinfeld where they bump into another George and another Kramer. Have you bumped into other actors' entourages?
You know, I see it more like with rap guys, rap stars, and athletes. Mark Wahlberg, of course, he still does a little bit, but now that he's got a little, you know, he's got two kids now, you don't see him with his entourage so much anymore. And, you know, I used to kind of hang in Mickey Rourke's entourage a little bit back in the day. And, you know, I'd go out, we'd roll like 12 guys deep, you know, and just front of the line to all the clubs and just get taken care of. And that was kind of fun.
Back to the competition now, and many people's favourite for the Palme d'Or on Sunday night is the diving bell and the butterfly, or in French, le scaphandre et le papillon. It's directed by American artist Julian Schnabel and adapted from the unfilmable book by former French Elle editor Jean-Dominique Bauby, who, paralysed after a stroke, dictated a book by blinking his left eye. It became a bestseller, which everyone loved, except me. It appears the film's going to be the same. Mathieu Amalric is great as the stricken victim, and the film does have visual flair, but there's not enough in it about facing death or using language, themes it raises but frustratingly skirts, in favour of looking up the skirts of various beautiful women who come to nurse Monsieur Bobby. Shot by Spielberg's regular cameraman, Janusz Kaminski, this is neither emotional enough to be a great American movie nor thoughtful enough to be a great French movie. It's good to see, though, that the Coen brothers are back to their best work with their new film, No Country for Old Men. This is funny, dark, and plaintive, with a great performance from Josh Brolin as an unlucky hick who finds a briefcase of $2 million and flees. But on his trail is deadly assassin Anton Chigurh, played by the superb Javier Bardem, with a ridiculous bowl haircut, who pursues his money armed with one of the strangest weapons in film history, a pneumatic cattle prod. Having begun his career with Almodovar in High Heels in 1991 and gone on to star in Jamon Jamon the year after, Javier then starred in Before Night Falls for director Julian Schnabel and then played a paraplegic in The Sea Inside. His thriving international career also includes Collateral and the recent Goya's Ghosts. He's off to film with Woody Allen in Barcelona next week, but I tracked Javier Bardem down to talk about Cannes, the Coens, and No Country for Old Men. Javier Bardem, Cannes, I think, is No Country for Old Men. I'm feeling really tired. You look all right, actually.
No, I'm excited. You're totally right. It's No Country, No Festival for Old Men.
But I have to say, your performance lifted me up. It was tremendous. I'd never seen you do that performance before. Mm-hmm. Totally new, you know, when an actor kind of completely cuts a whole... Is that what Joel and Ethan asked you to do, or did you just come and say, you know, I'm going to do this?
I think it was based on what the book was saying, how it was described on the book, and how they put it on the script. And basically, it's true that it was an open option, because Chigurh really doesn't belong to anywhere or to anybody, and there's not any reference that you can construct the character with. It was very open to what both of them wanted, and we start first of all with the hair.
So you got the character through the hair.
I mean, the hair helped us. Paul, the hairdresser, did a great job. He did like very easy thing, like peep peep. He put it together.
It wasn't a wig.
No, it was my hair. Yeah, really? I have the long hair because I don't know what they wanted, and he dried it. He put it like that, and he did this, and I loved it. I thought it was very helpful because you can see this kind of methodical thing of being in order through the hair, no? Mm. And the rest, I always saw the character as a tree trunk, that no matter how hard you hit it, it doesn't bend. And the brothers and I, we wanted to constrict the body, even being a little bit overweight, to put it in a place where it doesn't pay any attention in the way you walk and the way you move, even almost like out of sync, mostly clumsy.
Because there's a lot of walking. I mean, it's a good walking movie. I think there's a lot of corridors, a lot of shots of your feet. And I would have thought that you got the character through the feet first, and then maybe the hair.
Yeah, it was upside down.
The kind of interesting thing with it is you're saying that you obviously had discussions with them about the performance, and I'm always thinking of the Coen brothers as very easy directors, great writers, I think, because the scripts are always fantastic. But clearly they work quite hard with you on the performance.
Totally. I mean, they don't push you. They give you their ideas, and they let it open for you to bring your things. And if you have questions, if you have needs, they will always be there in order to help you. But at the end of the day, they really let you go, and because they know that at the end is you who has to belong the character, because you've been working with it. Hmm. And in that sense, it was a really funny and nice and creative experience, because we were finding it as long as we were shooting it. It's not something that we sit down and we talk, which we did. But there was a moment where, since it's not perfectly logical, we find it through little details, like the way he takes the paper, the way he sits down, the way he moves. And that was a funny moment where we were having fun, actually. The tense moments of the movie is nothing to do with the real shooting.
It was fun.
They have this relation with the joy of working. I mean, they know very well that nothing good comes out of tension. You can avoid tension moments, but nothing good comes out of tension. So the whole atmosphere of the set, since they work usually with the same people, is so totally relaxed and fun and enjoyable.
For many Americans, as it were, international audiences who saw you, The Sea Inside, I think probably was the last one they saw. Mm-hmm. They'd love to be aware to see Javier. You didn't move. You were in a bed for the whole thing. It was nice to see you in a film doing so much traveling.
Exactly. I move a lot in this one. Yeah. I even drive.
Is that why you took the part? You think, thank God, I can get up.
Exactly.
It's also a very... it's a funny movie, but it's a very dark movie. And I think it's... By the end, it's darker than even most people expect it to be.
Totally.
Did you know that was the way it was going to turn?
Yeah, I saw that on the book, and I saw that on the script, and I knew that the Coens are very loyal to their own principles, which is, if they choose this movie, it's because that end and that rhythm and that pace and that atmosphere has to be made in the way it's needed to be. I mean, they don't compromise the movie for anything. They really believe that this is the movie they want to make, and they make it no matter how the rules of marketing or whatever are. I don't know. I'm not expressing myself very well, but what I mean is, one of the things that you can count with is that if the Coens are doing this movie, it's going to be a very unique exercise of work, because they are not afraid of following the pattern. No,
this one I think may do you some big favors in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. I think this movie. Well, this part, at least.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm happy that people saw it, and the reaction here has been good, no? It's been a good one. And yes, I mean, I'm an actor, and I want to keep on working. That's all I want. I don't care where, as long as I like what I'm doing. I don't care where. So if this helps to find some other jobs, it's even better, no?
Yeah. And how are you finding Cannes? I mean, it is, as we mentioned, quite hard work.
I haven't been here 3 days, and I've been always in hotel rooms. And at night, you go take some dinner, have a drink, and go back to sleep, because at 8 o'clock, you are doing interviews. So,
but did you enjoy the gala night? You must have.
I don't know.
I don't know. Do you like a black tie?
No. No. I mean, I like for once, but not every time you have to go to see a movie.
I mean, things might go well, but you're not going to be James Bond unless you can
no,
wear
no,
that.
No. I mean, I don't have the face of being James Bond at all. I mean,
A James Bond villain.
They offered me that a long time ago, but I said, no. I mean, like, this is a villain, but this has a meaning in the story. And because the Coens are behind the camera, they really get the meaning out of it.
Well, people like the people saying, "Oh, Javier's great and he's nice." Normally, when you play a villain, people kind of say, "Oh, you don't want to talk to him; it's kind of creepy."
Exactly.
But you're a psychopathic killing machine. But who's nice?
Yeah, who's nice? No, like you will let your daughter with me to take a walk in the park.
Well, I don't have a daughter, so it's more easy for me to say exactly.
Exactly.
But I like the philosophy of it, the whole.
So, like, that's why I think it's a good exercise, because I knew that they will take very good care of that, and they will transcend the fact of being a killing machine, that there will something weird there that people will play with it for a while. No?
And finally, just the mad world of cinema that is Cannes. It's quite funny that you're in competition as an actor in the Coen movie, and then your old director, Julian Schnabel, from Before Night Falls, is in competition with an movie about a guy who's paralyzed in a bed, which is what you were famous for The Sea Inside. How mad is that?
That's weird, but I'm staying one more day here because I want to see it. I hear it's beautiful, and I'm dying to see it, and I wish Julian the best, because he deserves it.
You're still in touch with him?
Yes, we are friends. I mean, he has one of the biggest hearts I've ever felt in a man. He's really, really deeply caring for people. I mean, in a way that is shocking to see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
he's a nice man.
Big tummy as well.
Yeah, exactly. And for himself too.
Javier, congratulations. Lovely to see you.
Thank you very much.
Javier Bardem there.
One of the other stars of No Country for Old Men is Josh Brolin, an actor who's been around for 20 years without ever quite landing a breakthrough role, until now. He's marvellous as the mustachioed Llewellyn Moss trying to get a break from his trailer park lifestyle with the discovery of the money. Your heart goes out to his hangdog but determined face. Brolin is perhaps best known as Barbara Streisand's stepson through Babs's marriage to his father, James Brolin, and for marrying the beautiful actress Diane Lane 3 years ago. Josh Brolin's previous films include The Goonies, Best Laid Plans, Mimic, and Flirting with Disaster. I caught up with him at the Carlton Hotel. Josh, congratulations on your performance in No Country for Old Men. You really are terrific in it.
Thank you, man. Thank you very much.
And I don't mean that as a, like, I'm surprised that you're terrific in it, but
some people seem to be.
Yeah, let's put it this way. I hadn't seen you in a role like that before, and basically being the main thrust of a movie's plot.
Right.
It must have been quite a joy to get such a part. I thought because the writing's so good.
That's the difference. Is the writing's so good, the filmmakers are so good, and to be involved. I mean, I've been involved with a lot of different parts, and especially in theater, I've always been perceived as someone who can do drama and comedy and this and that or whatever, you know, the part calls for. It's just on a grander scale. I think that it's interesting, and to me, it's fine if people want to, you know, perceive this as, you know, we thought he was this, and now he's that, or he was a schlocky TV actor, and now he's this.
I think something for UK audiences, because we don't get your...
Right.
Obviously, in the US, you're known for some theater. You know, if you can go to New York, and you know that you've been on Broadway.
Well, I would imagine that it would be kind of similar to Javier and what he did, you know, having done like 25 films in Spain, and then he does Before Night Falls, and everybody goes, oh, my God, we had no idea. Yet it's in the same country for me. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So when you get a part like this and you're at Cannes and you become the lead, is there a sense that you would take on a mantle, or is it just another job? You treat it just like another gig?
No, I mean, I think it's different. Not that I feel, you know, better about everything. I just feel really proud to be at a place like Cannes with a film like No Country for Old Men, because it just... Listen, man, if I wasn't in this movie, I would watch this movie over and over and over, because it's a kind of movie that I love, and I think it represents something very emotional and very, you know, exhausting and a survivalist story, and I like those kind of stories myself. I'm a huge fan of Cormac's. I think they've done a really loyal job with Cormac's story, with their own little personal twist to it, which is impossible for them not to do. And if there's any kind of notoriety that comes out of this, I love that it's a Coen Brothers film, man. It's much better for me, and it's a lot easier for me to talk about and to be proud of, you know, all of us.
Are you a Coen Brothers fan?
I've always been a Coen Brothers fan.
Really?
No.
We
don't want to talk to them, right? No, I've always been a Coen Brothers fan. I've watched all of their movies many times, and it wasn't whether I liked more than I liked others, some more than I liked others, or, you know, it's a very subjective thing with them because they have such a personal, subjective take on everyday life and exploit all our absurdities in such a brilliant way that to be involved in that in a genre that they haven't necessarily tackled in this way. You know, Miller's Crossing was serious but had, you know, hilarious laugh-out-loud moments that were intended. You know, Blood Simple was more kind of a study in style, and it was their first movie, so they were, you know, barreling through it the best they knew how because they didn't have any reference at that point. Whereas this thing seems to be them just kind of saying, fuck it.
This was, it was. But I wondered if you had any previous Coen character in mind when you got the script or when you stood on set? I mean, you create one totally.
No, I know
what
you mean. Yeah.
But did you have? I know a lot. He had a touch of the Lebowskis about him, strangely enough. Although he's far more kind of together.
Can you imagine? No, this was the younger version of Jeff Bridges playing the dude. Really? No, I should say that. I should have said this whole interview process.
This
for
is
the
why
3 days.
Yeah.
This was my rendition of a young Jeff Bridges.
Totally. I mean, you know, you get the cowboy boots, the whole
no,
thing.
No, I know.
Sam Elliott would have been proud of it.
Right? It's true, right? It's true. No. I didn't have any preconceived idea. I don't know what a Coen Brothers character is. You know, I know maybe at most you could go so far as to say exaggerated. I don't know, maybe a little tongue-in-cheek. For me. You know, I think of The Big Lebowski, or I think of Marge in Fargo, mm-hmm. you know, or something like that, where it's pushed to the limits of character. You know, maybe Javier's performance a little bit, you know, becomes a little mythological, but I don't think that there's anything, there's subtleties that are humorous, mm-hmm. but there's not really laugh out loud, other than discomfort.
What I liked about your Llewellyn is the way he initially you thought he was a kind of, you know, trailer park stoner in the couch kind of
dim.
Yeah. Naive. I mean, you even calls it, I think in the opening scene, he sort of says, oh, they're going to shoot my dumb ass. And you kind of think, well, he's just a kind of stupid kind of guy.
Okay.
But the guy, he's pretty together. He's pretty professional when he gets going. He's the kind of moves of an assassin, you know?
And that was one thing that we talked about, the fact that we don't let on early that he could stand up against somebody, the Grim Reaper, you know, so to speak, with Javier, and wanted to feel like we were slowly learning this guy. And as we slowly learned who this guy was, you start to have the Vietnam reference, and you start to realize that somebody who is laconic as he is isn't necessarily dim. And that's, I think, everybody's perception. Everybody who's not from that area, even in America, looks at somebody from that terrain and that setting and just say they're dumb. They talk like this, and they sound stupid, and they talk a little slow, and, you know.
Where are you from?
I'm from Central Coast, California. I'm from a farming horse community.
Because you took to the livestock kind of thing quite well.
Yeah, I think Tommy and I come from, you know, similar backgrounds, and not in the prep school, you know, way, but I think, you know, we were both raised in around people who are, you know, loyalists and kind of laconic and have a lot of integrity. And
but that world of kind of dusty highways and motel rooms, is that a world you know at
it's
all?
It's a world I love, and it's a world my wife loves now, you know. Yeah, we take a lot of road trips, and I took a lot of road trips with my mother when I was a kid, and took a lot of road trips with Diane recently, you know. And I stay in $25 motels.
Really?
We love it, man. We honestly love it. I don't say that.
She doesn't mind?
Some kind of affect. No, she prefers.
Yeah.
It does not that she doesn't mind. She prefers.
I always think of her doing up that Tuscan villa, you know.
Well, that's okay. We just keep watching those movies so we can stay in our $25 motels.
And congratulations also on your very brief Chaque Instant Cinema tweet, the short that you did for Journalism.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah.
Which was a lovely little...
Oh, good. You saw
thing.
It.
Yeah, when you, again, the laconic guy going in and saying... Well, yeah. Am I going to like the Turkish movie? Am I going to like the...
Different character, but fun, funny.
Best line of the festival.
Yeah.
Any livestock in it.
Yeah, right. Any livestock.
Josh, congratulations. Send on off to Diane.
Thank you.
Good luck with this movie. I really think that you could be in for some good fun with this part.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It has been said that Hollywood films are interesting things happening to attractive people. Well, time and again, the things I really like here at a festival like Cannes mainly involve terrible things happening to poor people far away. That's world cinema for you, I guess. My personal favourites this Cannes were Blind Mountain from China's Li Yang, about a poor girl sold to be a peasant's wife and imprisoned on a farm. Romania's 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days by Cristi Mungiu, a grippingly grim tale about a student helping a friend to have an illegal abortion in the last decrepit days of communism. And The Pope's Toilet, or El Baño del Papa, about a Uruguayan building an outhouse for the visit of John Paul II in a mountain village. It's the directing debut of César Chalón, who shot City of God and The Constant Gardener for Fernando Morales, and it's sad and very moving, as well as warm-hearted and humane. Playing in the director's fortnight sidebar, the only British hit was Control, a cool black-and-white story of Ian Curtis, the Joy Division singer, who died in 1980 at the age of 23. Directed by photographer Anton Corbin, who took the band's pics for NME back in the day, it features a startling performance by total newcomer Sam Riley, whose uncanny embodiment of Curtis dancing, singing and, indeed, talking had Cannes hailing a new British star. I bring you his first big interview. So, Sam, tell me what were you doing before you got this part?
The last few years prior to this, I was a singer in a rock and roll band, 10,000 Things. We were never particularly successful, but we did tour for 2.5, 3 years around the country. So I know something of that life. But it's a case of forgetting everything that you do on stage and doing something somebody else does. So when I was auditioning for this film, I was working in a bar in Leeds and folding shirts in a retail warehouse. I tried to be an actor when I was 19 or 20, and I had a couple of TV parts. I played a fisherman in Peak Practice, which is an English granny programme on Sunday nights, basically. And I auditioned for millions of things for about a year, but didn't enjoy it, was pretty miserable. And then the band started doing quite well, so I told my agent I didn't want to be an actor anymore. And then when the band got dropped, I rang her after 5 years.
Did you like being on television?
I didn't like the auditioning, and I didn't like the parts, and I didn't really want to. I was scared of getting well known, actually, as a television star or something. That idea really terrified me, actually.
You played the epilepsy scenes with a lot of realism. Did you research that? And did you, how were they to play?
But the thing with epilepsy, when I was doing my research into it, there's a lot of fear attached with it, because you don't really know when the next one's coming. You can have an aura as to when the next one's coming, but it's only 20 seconds before. You can die from a fit. It can be such a shock to the brain. Or you can be brain damaged. It can happen anywhere, and it can be very humiliating. And then the medication in those days, more so than today, was pretty archaic. And the thing was, you'd have to take one type of pill for 6 months to see whether it works, and if it didn't, then you'd have to start again on the next one. And they had physical side effects with rashes and moods, and on the mood, psychological problems. I think that was definitely a major aspect in his misery.
So your first time, actor Sam Morton had never acted before when she burst onto the scene. Nora Jones made her debut at Cannes, she never acted before. It's easy, this acting, isn't it?
Music and acting's easy. So, you know, we just don't want to tell anyone that, or everyone will think they can do it, which is true. Yeah.
Anyone can do it, because people go to RADA for 5 years and pay a fortune.
I know, and then that usually ruins them as well, don't they? They all come out talking the same. I'm not going to get invited there now, am I?
You don't need it.
They turned me down anyway when I was 18. I tried for it. When I was at school, I went to auditions there, but I was too young and not good enough. It was easy, really. Yeah. Looking into those eyes and pretending to be in love was not a very difficult. In fact, that was the easiest part of the whole movie. I wasn't nervous about that.
That view of the Indies 80 band, it was a bit of a heyday for British music and that sort of era. What do you think of music now?
I don't know. I think maybe if you were young at the time, then it's always going to be connected with memories of not having a job and having a good time in your life. Music comes in cycles, and whatever era you live in, some people are going to be thinking this is the best era ever for music, I think. This is a bit of a dream come true, really, for me. My first film in black and white, playing the lead part, playing a singer in Cannes, with people who say that it was pretty good. So, I mean, this is a dream come true. Whatever comes next is surplus.
Sam Riley, Britain's Cannes discovery and the star of Control. Well, there's much more I could tell you about. How I drank with Don Johnson, stood on Jim Jarmusch's foot, had my photo in Variety, how I emulated Peter O'Toole by lifting a £200,000 diamond necklace in a Riviera villa, how I watched football with Jim Sheridan, nodded hello to Sharon Stone and met model Lily Cole, even watched fireworks with Emily Watson. You'll just get jealous, so I won't mention them. So that's it for Cannes 2007. I'm off to get married and go on honeymoon, so we'll be taking a break for 3 weeks, giving you time to catch up with all the films we've covered in our first season of Film Weekly. So I've just got to thank my producer, Paul Noble, for having to listen to the glamour while editing it all down, to tell Tessa I love you, and to wish you all happy viewing, and to say from Cannes, au revoir et vive le cinéma!